thanks for tuning in to On the Same Page, a new podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library to keep you in the loop and on the same page about what's happening at your library. Welcome back
to another episode of On the Same Page.
Thanks for tuning in.
It is May 1st.
If you were unable to see Nathan Englander when he was here during Festival of the Book to celebrate our inaugural Same Page community read, then we've got a treat for you.
We recorded it, so you get to experience it too, and it's very entertaining.
Yes. We've had to cut it a bit for length, but I think that you get all the best parts.
Yes. We're happy that he came in and shared his experience with us.
Yes.
We're also going to talk about some books.
As always.
Yep. Okay, so book talk. So now that it's no longer National Poetry Month, we can talk about some books that aren't
poetry related. You want to go first?
Sure. I was trying to read Feed by M.T. Anderson, which Lynn Hill talked about in one of our episodes a few months ago, that they read for the Northside Young Adult Book Club for adults. But I checked out the first Feed that I found on Overdrive, and as it turned out, that was actually the first in a different series by Mira Grant. And so that's the first in a series called the News Flesh Trilogy. And that's a zombie story where young people have become reporters and bloggers. And like, this is really sort of the what it means to be a celebrity now is to be somebody who creates and records the news. And so I read that, and so it's somewhere between a story about news and a story about zombies. And it was interesting. I enjoyed it. And then I did read the other Feed by M.T. Anderson. And that one is about a reality where if you can afford it, people have implants in their brains, which it's basically like a smartphone in your brain. You can chat to people online in your brain.
For the future.
Or you can get ads in your brain. When you look at something, if you just think about it, you can get all the information about it and like where you can buy it. And so I read both of those, and they were very different. Both young adult novels called Feed. But they're interesting. I really enjoyed them.
Okay, so I am currently reading Enlightenment Now.
Are you feeling enlightened?
Yes, because I'm texting you everything I'm learning. That's how I know.
Erica keeps sending me these nuggets of information that she gets, and it starts with, he says this, and I have no idea what she's talking about, and they're all, like, somewhat related, but it spans so much different kind of thought that I always assume it's a different book than the last one she was talking about.
So it's by Steven Pinker, and the reason I picked it up was because Bill Gates highly recommended it. And it's kind of, he's just covering everything you might think is wrong with the world and proving why it's not as wrong as you think. Or not, things aren't as bad as you think. And it's really, really interesting. It is quite long, and it's very information heavy. But it's kind of empowering and uplifting to be like, oh, like the reason we're paying so much attention to terrorism is because there are so few other threats to our safety and health that we can really, this can affect us now. It's not just one of many things.
Interesting.
So the other book I read, which I was so excited to get, I've had on hold forever, was Juno Diaz, his new picture book,
yes,
called Island Born. The English version is called Island Born. The Spanish language version is called Lola. So I read it in English. And it's about a little girl who has to write about the country she came from, or draw a picture about the country she came from. But she came to America when she was such a little baby, she doesn't actually have memories of the country she came from, which is the Dominican Republic, where he is from. And so she has to ask everyone she knows. She asks her cousin, and she asks her grandma and her mom, and then she asks the neighbor, and she gets these really great stories, but because she's a young child, the metaphors become literal to her. So when someone's like, oh, the bats are as big as blankets, she's like is envisioning these blanket-sized bats
And so the illustrations are very whimsical and colorful, and it makes you want to go.
So it's great for littles of all types.
Yeah.
That's exciting. Is that his first children's book?
Uh-huh.
So we hope you will check out those books.
Yes. Literally, check those out.
Yes. They shouldn't have as many holes as they did when we read them. And now we're going to hear from Nathan Englander.
Yes.
On behalf of Virginia Humanities, the producer of the Virginia Festival Book, the Friends of the Library, and the Jefferson Madison Regional Library System, we'd like to welcome you to the Northside Library for JMRL's inaugural St. Paige Community-Wide Reading Event. A special thanks to the festival's many sponsors and community partners, without whom these events would not be possible. And a special thanks to the Friends of the Library for this evening's program. Now please help me welcome this evening's moderator. Linda Colbert is a local writer and educator. She currently serves as editor of the UVA Medical Humanities Journal, Hospital Drive. Her poetry and prose have appeared in the American Journal of Nursing, Lunch Ticket, Pulse, and numerous other publications. She also teaches writing classes at local public libraries.
Can I be heard? So, I have the pleasure of introducing Nathan Englander. Nobody who has read anything that Nathan has written can be surprised to learn that he grew up in the traditional Orthodox Jewish community on Long Island, or that he, in his 20s, he lived in Israel for 5 years. His first story collection, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, was published in 1999. Since that time, Nathan Englander has won many prizes, awards, fellowships. His work has appeared in many distinguished publications, including The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post, as well as the O. Henry Prize stories and numerous editions of the Best American Short Stories. In addition to For Relief of Unbearable Urges, Nathan has 3 other books. These include 2 novels, The Ministry of Special Cases, Dinner at the Center of the Earth, and the book that we'll talk about tonight, the short story collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, which was the finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2013 and was awarded the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. Nathan Englander serves as Distinguished Writer in Residence at New York University and lives in Brooklyn with his wife and daughter. Please join me in welcoming Nathan Englander.
Thank you for that nice introduction. Thank you all for having me. It's great to be here and to be back in your town. I've been here a few times. Anyway, sew buttons on your shoes. I'm really touched by this community reading, all of your investment in this book, and I'm looking forward to the Q&A, and don't want to read your ears off, but I'll read for, like, I believe in the Geneva Convention. I get very nervous when people start reading from a book and I'm not warned. It was in Nigeria. Once this writer got up with a whole stack of books and said, I'm just going to read a little bit from every book I've ever written. And then I panicked. Anyway, but I'll just read for like 7 or 6 or 8 minutes. Just so you can hear my voice as a reader. I'm a reader before a writer, and I always like to hear a writer's voice. I'll just dig in a little bit. This is my tour copy. I haven't seen this book in years. It's been probably 5 years since I've read from this book, because I'm onto the new book. You get so tired on the road, and then I always keep the bad inscription. I wrote with all your best. It's supposed to be with all my best. and then I trade it. What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. They're in our house maybe 10 minutes, and already Mark's lecturing us on the Israeli occupation. Mark and Lauren live in Jerusalem, and people from there think it gives them the right. Mark's looking all stoic and nodding his head. If we had what you have down here in South Florida, he says, and trails off. Yup, he says, and he's nodding again. We'd have no troubles at all. You do have what we have, I tell him. All of it. Sun and palm trees, old Jews and oranges, and the worst drivers around. At this point, I say, we've probably got more Israelis than you. Debbie, my wife, she puts a hand on my arm. Her signal that I'm taking a tone or interrupting someone's story, sharing something private, or making an inappropriate joke. That's my cue. and I'm surprised, considering how much I get it, that she ever lets go of my arm. Yes, you've got it all now, Mark says, even terrorists. I look to Lauren. She's the one my wife has the relationship with, the one who should take charge. But Lauren isn't going to give her husband any signal. She and Mark ran off to Israel 20 years ago and turned Hasidic, and neither of them will put a hand on the other in public. Not for this, not to put out a fire. Wasn't Muhammad Atta living right here before 9/11, Mark says, and now he pantomimes pointing out houses. Goldberg, 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 Atta. How'd you miss him in this place? Other side of town, I say. That's what I'm talking about. That's what you have that we don't. Other sides of town, wrong sides of the track, space upon space. And now he's fingering granite countertop in our kitchen, looking out into the living room and the dining room, staring through the kitchen windows out at the pool. All this house, he says, and one son. Can you imagine? No, Lauren says, and then she turns to us, backing him up. You should see how we live with 10. 10 kids, I say. We could get your reality show with that here in the States, help you get a bigger place. The hands back pulling at my sleeve. Pictures, Debbie says. I want to see the girls. We all follow Lauren into the den for her purse. Do you believe it, Mark says. 10 girls. And the way it comes out of his mouth, it's the first time I like the guy. The first time I think about giving him a chance. Facebook and Skype brought Deb and Lauren back together. They were glued at the hip growing up, went to school together their whole lives, yeshiva school, all girls. Out in Queens through high school and then riding the subway together to one called Central in Manhattan. They stayed best friends forever until I married Deb and turned her secular. And soon after that, Lauren met Mark and they went off to the Holy Land and went from Orthodox to ultra-Orthodox, which to me sounds like a repackaged detergent. Orthodox Ultra, now with more deep healing. Because of that, we're supposed to call them Shoshana and Yerucham. Deb's been doing it. I'm just not saying their names. You want some water, I offer? Coke in the can? You, which of us, Mark says. You both, I say. I got whiskey. Whiskey's kosher too, right? If it's not, I'll kosher it up real fast, he says, pretending to be easygoing. And right then he takes off that big black hat and plops down on the couch in the den. Lauren's holding the verticals aside and looking out at the yard. Two girls from Forest Hill, she says. Whoever thought we'd be the mothers of grown-ups? Trevor's 16, Deb says. You may think he's a grown-up, and he may think he's a grown-up, but we are not convinced. Well, Lauren says, then whoever thought we'd have kids raised to think it's normal to have coconuts crashing out back and lizards climbing the walls? Right then is when Trev comes padding into the den, all 6 feet of him, plaid pajama bottoms dragging on the floor and t-shirt full of holes. He's just woken up and you can tell he's not sure if he's still dreaming. We told him we had guests, but there's Trev, staring at this man in the black suit, a beard resting on the middle of his stomach. And Lauren, I'd met her once before, right when Deb and I got married. But 10 girls and 1,000 Shabbos dinners later, well, she's a big woman in a bad dress and a giant blonde Marilyn Monroe wig. Seeing them at the door, I can't say I wasn't shocked myself. But the boy, he can't hide it on his face. Hey, he says. And then Deb's on him preening and fixing his hair and hugging him. Trevi, this is my best friend from childhood, she said. This is Shoshana and this is Mark, I say. Yerucham, Mark says, and sticks out a hand. Trev shakes it, then Trev sticks out his hand, polite to Lauren. She just looks at it, just hanging there in the air, offered. I don't shake, she says. But I'm so happy to see you, like meeting my own son. I mean it, she says. And here she starts to cry for real. And she and Deb are hugging, and Deb's crying too. And the boys, we just stand there until Mark looks at his watch and gets himself a good manly grip on Trev's shoulder. Sleeping until 3 on a Sunday. Man, those were the day, Mark says. A regular little rumpled foreskin. Trev looks at me and I want to shrug, but Mark's also looking so I don't move. Trev just gives us both his best teenage glare and edges out of the room. As he does, he says, baseball practice, and takes my car keys off the hook by the door to the garage. There's gas, I say. They let him drive here at 16, Mark says. Insane. So what brings you, I say, after all these years? Deb's too far away to grab at me, but her face says it all. Was I supposed to know? I say, geez, Deb must have told me. She told me for sure. My fault. My mother, Mark says, she's failing and my father's getting old and they come to us for Sukkot everywhere, you know? I know the holidays, I say. They used to fly out to us for Sukkot and Pesach both, but they can't fly now and I just wanted to get over while things are still good. We haven't been in America. Oh gosh, Lauren says, I'm afraid to think how long it's been. More than 10 years, 12, she says, 12 years ago. With the kids, it's just impossible until enough of them are big. This might be. And now she plops down on the couch. This might be my first time in a house with no kids under the roof in that long. Oh my, I'm serious. How weird, I feel faint. And when I say faint, she says, standing up, giving an oddly girlish spin around. What I mean is giddy. How do you do it, Deb says. 10 kids, I really do want to hear. That's when I remember. I forgot your drink, I say to Mark. Yes, his drink. That's how, Lauren says. That's how we cope. I'll stop right there.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
So I've read that you don't like to call your work political.
Yes.
But it seems to me that there, at least in these stories, there's a clear message, maybe sort of even a lesson that might be thought of as political.
Oh, you're yeah.
Even if it's not the point of the story. So can you talk about your intent with your writing?
Sure.
Like, how conscious are you of including that sort of message or lesson?
I'll stand here. Maybe I'll shift. I don't need to start out being difficult, but those answers, I'm saying, I'm not going to be difficult now. I'm being difficult in whatever I said. It's not political. I really have to split my own self out. A writer's job is to, like, control point of view or be aware of point of view. So I spend all this time when I'm writing this story, I have to be Lauren and I have to be Mark and I have to be the friends visiting and I have to be the kid walking into the room. It's my job to be able to, like, see the room from above and be an effort. So even I think it sort of bleeds into talking about writing. So my intent, I can state that it's not political, and that was the nicest way to say it, which is, you know, your work's super political. So, you know, it's built into the question. So, yes, the outcome and my intent, it doesn't matter what I think, and it's nice of you to come out. I so appreciate you coming out and investing in my work, and I will share my thoughts, and I hope they're edifying, but I also understand that the work belongs to you. Like, your read is the only read. You know, when I put it into the work, here's me. I'm literally, we're setting up the image. There's me, here's the book, and then there's a book in between us. Like, that's the shared consciousness is when we all go into story. But what I want doesn't matter. So, yes, it's just the way my head ticks. So that's the point. I'm just telling a story. I think I'm just wound politically, maybe. So, there's two things. The more complicated and obvious version of this, which might annoy even more than writing. I mean, I literally just wrote a book on Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Gender at the Center of the Earth. The last one's about the dirty war in Argentina. They're all hyper-political, but it's just me telling story, and that's what I gravitate to, which is injustice. That's why I'm not writing about politics. I'm obsessed with gray space. I'm obsessed with injustice. I can't handle that the world's not fair, and I tell stories. And the more extreme example of that is I understand that pretty much every character in every book I write is Jewish, and all the logic is Jewish, and the jokes are Jewish, and the themes are Jewish, and the history is Jewish. I have never written a word about Jews, not one. Like, I'm not a Jewish writer. To me, I understand facing me, I'm in Charlottesville, probably look like a Jewish writer from there, but, like, I'm just saying, like, I grew up in a world, my house, we were all, the world was Orthodox. Like, we didn't even have really Jewish people in our world who weren't religious. Like, so it's not only that it was like, you know, forget that I have vague memories of, like, you know, the Sacred Heart girl from across the, I can see the plaid coming in and out of focus, but, like, you know, so that idea, if I grew up in an Orthodox world and went to an Orthodox place to worship and went to an Orthodox school and Orthodox Jewish camps, and then when I broke away like a wild man and went to State University that was like 90% Jewish and everyone is from other parts of Long Island, you know, like, and then for junior year I went to Jerusalem and met like Belgian Jews, like, I'm just saying the whole world is Jews to me, and that's not, you know, it's just not a type of, so the same as the Pinnacle, same with the Jewish thing, like I'm telling my stories, and it's, you know, I spent, the only reason I want to be hyphenated now is because I need not say, you know, it's definitely being talked about in America, and definitely in this time, is just because of the, you know, dark people coming out of the shadows, you know, our Nazis and our racists and our, like, go back to the shadows with you. But I'm saying, now I want my hyphen, now I'll be a Jewish writer, because don't mess with me, please. But I'm saying, I'm fifth generation American, and it's like, that notion took me so long to say why I was racist and Jewish or anything, which is because I'm not a type of American. You know what I'm saying? My family's been here long before the president, so I don't have to be a style of American, you know? So in that way, I recognize that I write about Jews endlessly and write about politics endlessly, and that these things are all over my work. But from inside my head, from my point of view, I just tell stories about people, and they always end up being Jewish and always end up being political.
Well, since you brought it up. Yeah. So, in many of these stories, there's this undercurrent of fear that I sense.
I'm also very afraid.
And so, just days after August 11th and 12th here in Charlottesville, those events, you wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in which you sort of recall your own fears growing up, fears of being beaten up or humiliated in some way. And you talk about how when Barack Obama was elected, there seemed to be a shift. And no longer were the young Jewish boys having to hide their yarmulkes, and you know, they could shout at a basketball game and draw attention to themselves in a way that you felt awkward about when you were growing up. And then, in the last year or so, you talked about how there's also been another shift. So I wonder if you can talk to us about how, about that piece in the New York Times?
Sure,
how it relates to your
work. Yeah, again, you're all more expert than me. I was just watching the news, but, you know, I mean, we had a person killed by a Nazi on American soil. That's, you know, so, yeah, I just was remembering the way I grew up, which is the chase home from school, fight your way home from school, you know, Hitler should have finished you all, dirty Jew, like all that stuff that we got all the time, you know, the swastika, you know, shaving cream swastika on the door for Halloween. Just part of the stuff's part of, it's just part of growing up with a yarmulke, like learn to fight, you know what I'm saying? Learn to fight, took karate, learn to fight. Karate Kid, we're all like, oh yeah, I can fight too. Anyway, but yeah, that was just part of life, you know, not, you know, just the way we understand, you know, where Mad Men is charming. It's not charming to my mother's, you know, generation as a show, you know, being pawed at work. We're like, ooh, look at the outfits, you know. So I think things you know, maybe lived with. I just was really moved looking at New York, and it's not just the Obama year. It's before that. But, like, you know, the kids who are not kids now in their 20s and teens, like kids with a yarmulke, it's a whole new New York. And I'm so, you know what I'm saying? It's just beautiful to me to see what the subway looks like now, what New York feels like now, you know. And that's why I use the example of the, you know, a Nets game where I was like, wow, all of New York, there's a kosher food stand and all of New York is here and everyone's as themselves. I really, it's beautiful to me. Like, you know, for my gay friends, it was a big deal coming out. And again, not that any of these battles are over, but just when I see young kids who are comfortable being themselves, whatever that self is, not as other, just as a normal, like that is point, you are normal as you are. There's not a definitive way to be. It was stunning to me and beautiful to me. I was so proud of our country. And back to evolution, there is right and wrong. Like, I never bring politics into my classroom, you know, at NYU, like that idea, but there is a point where there's right and wrong. You know, we talk about, you know, politicians flip-flopping and stuff like that. You can develop and evolve as a person. It's not a flip-flop to recognize all people should have the right to marry. That's not a flip-flop in your position. That's an evolution to what's right, you know? And again, you can disagree with me. You can also be wrong, you know, like, that's fine, you know, on other things. But I'm saying there are the things we can talk about, which is like school vouchers. I always use that as a good example. As an ex-religious kid, what my sister and brother-in-law pay for to have a religious education and get zero from the public schools, they can make a really good argument with all their kids that there should be school vouchers. And I can make a really good argument about, you know, what it is to have a public school. That's like differences of opinion and an argument, but then there's just right and wrong.
And this notion, you know, of a better America where people are accepted and feel safe as they are, different religions, different colors, different identities, all that notion, yes, to see that change, I don't know, I never write nonfiction, never write those pieces, but as I said, back to cowardliness, I can hear the other side of anything. If you tell me right now my name's not Nathan, I promise you I will pause and say, like, do you know something? Like, is it jet lag? Am I having a mini stroke? Is this a dream? I take no sides on anything. I will hear the other side of everything except Nazis no bueno. Like, they're just bad. And it was just, it's really clear to me. Yes, I just wanted to write a piece about where I came from and where we are now, and that it is not acceptable to move back the other way. It's just not. And then, you know, back to writing books, words matter. Like, from the highest levels, of, these messages come out and people react because we have responsibilities, you know, whether it's Facebook or the White House, or like, what you say matters, especially if you have influence. You know what I'm saying? You shouldn't be hubristic. Like, I don't write a book and say I'm going to change things with a book, but I, as a reader, I have been changed by books, but especially coming from the single highest office in this country to say that it's okay, it's not an accident. I think anti-Semitic incidents are up something like 57% this year. It's just the violence in this country, what we see, it is being empowered, and that, it's not a position. You know what I'm saying? There aren't good people on both sides if one side foments genocide.
So I think we will open up the floor to your questions. Does anybody have a question that they'd like to?
Yeah, and we can stick to, but I don't, you know, surely don't need, I surely don't need to rant about politics or, again, unless there's a pro-Nazi side, there's not really anything. That question is done. But yes.
When you wrote this story, what we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank, did you have the end scene in mind? Were you going there
the
whole
time? I can repeat it. Yeah, okay. So, but yes, did I have the end scene in mind for the story? And I'm sure there's some writers in the room. I love talking about craft, but I'll keep it short on that front, which is when you write, like, I'm alone in the room all day with my sidekick, me dog is at my side, but you know, alone in the room all day, you know, I meet my buddy for ping pong when I need to clear my head. Anyway, but you know, I call it executing the inexecutable. I'm not interested in writing anything, a book or a story that I think I can write. You know, that's the moment of the idea. Whatever it is, whether you hear a conversation or see a couple or think of a structure, when I know I can't get there, when there's no logical way to build it, that's when I want to work. So yes, I really feel like I felt that last moment and said, how can I pull a world apart in this closet? And then I back up from there. And the other birth of that story, it wasn't always married to the Carver story. Again, we're in a library, so I do want to talk as a reader a lot more here, which is, I was writing this story and had two couples in a room, you know, and this, you know, drinking this bottle of vodka, and I had another member was like, oh, I remember this story with two couples in a room, a bottle of gin, the changing light of day, you know, like I could feel the day changing. And that's what I thought is the power of story, which there's no other art form that, like, forms memories. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's with fiction, you read words, the words are just symbols. So that's why when I say kitchen in this story, we all picture our kitchens, whether it's, you know, Charlottesville or Fredericksburg or Montreal, or you just, whether top floor, bottom floor, whether that, you know, kitchen is McDonald's or your butler, you know, it's just, you work with kitchen. As soon as you add the granite countertops, then there's a countertop in there. It's from negative space, from infinity, that we build story. And that's why, there, as I say, if you say, like, you know, when was I mauled by a bear? Oh, that was The Revenant. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's, go to a neurologist. Like, if you start remembering movies as memory, that's a problem. But story, like, I literally had this memory. And I was like, oh, I didn't, that's what I'm saying too. I didn't remember words. I didn't remember language. I saw two couples and the change and the bottle of gin. And then I was like, oh, that's the Carver story. You know, and I felt like, you have to break your rules as a writer all the time. The only rule I won't break is your obligation is to story. That's it. You want to go to a party on Friday night and your book needs work? Too bad. Obligation is to story. You want everyone to die in a fiery crash, but they're going to go to Six Flags and ride the flume? Too bad. You listen to your story, Dirk. And it was one rule I had, which was like, I always like whole cloth. Don't ever echo anything. I want a story to stand on its own in that way. You know, like maybe a biblical reference, but I'm saying in terms of modern literature, I don't do that in that way. And then I thought, but now this story's mine because it's my memory. And that's the moment that I married the two stories together. And, you know, when I made it an homage to the carver, and, you know, when I finished, I went back and read it and, you know, really made sure they were woven in that way. But yeah, back to this final, you know, and on that final scene and on the Anne Frank game, which is, you know, I'm sure why I'm here today and what we're talking about, which is back to normalcy, which is, I think, you know, back to this great, still great country of ours that was never not great, and we do need to make it greater now. I do agree on that part now. Anyway, but you don't know, your life is normal to you until you get, you know what I'm saying? I wore a yarmulke and sits in a coat. Like, I don't know, you know, other stuff. That's just, if you have, you know, beer for breakfast on your cereal, it's not till college that you're going to pour beer in the cafeteria on your Cheerios and your friends are going to be like, what's that? You're like, breakfast? They'll be like, no, it's not. You know, like, and for me, as an American, my sister and I were fifth generation Americans, and I think about how brain works and education, how much the Holocaust as a religious kid was given to me. You know, the only accents in my family are, you know, Boston. There's no like babushkas or old country people. You didn't have any of that. We're Yankees, you know? So, to me, I just wondered how our brains got that way, but my sister and I, whenever we meet, till into adulthood, if we'd like meet a new couple, we just had a shorthand, which is, we'd say like, oh yeah, good couple, be like, he'd hide us, she'd drop a dime in a minute. Like, as it is in the story, we really made order and trust by who would hide us if a second Holocaust happened, because we were really raised with the notion, which is, again, what we're talking about. I thought it was so crazy and so rebellious that a country could change fast, but I was always raised that that nothing ever ends well for the Jews and never get comfortable, and I thought that was so crazy and rejected it, but really did play that game, and it was only on third book. Like, I write distant from myself, but with the third book I said, you know what? That's bizarre and twisted and pathological, and that's where story comes from. It's literally the most normal thing in the world for me and my sister to be like, oh yeah, like, it's how we judge people. Would they hide us in a Holocaust? Wow. And then I said, like, oh, I'm gonna write that as a story. And you know, the unbeautiful thing, back to that op-ed, people make jokes about Jews having a lot of money. If we kept all the change thrown at us, that New York Times piece, I got more letters from more people who've had pennies thrown at them in this country than I could have imagined. But the beautiful thing on the Who Would Hide Me game, I was so moved, and I'm very fortunate, like, I probably went to 10 or 12 countries last book, to see how this game gets played across culture, across, you know, that, you know, immediately one of my first interviews, someone played that she and her family, they played the Underground Railroad game, like, who would hide them if they were runaway slaves. Someone told me, her son, they played the Basque separatist version. It's like Monopoly. There's like one for every tragedy. But it was so moving to me, the way story works, to see how universal that game is based on, you know, religious, cultural, personal, you know, historical trauma that really, I've met so many people who've shared with me that they play their version of this really dark game. Wow. Yes, sir.
I'm interested in your craft, and I wonder, with a book of short stories, whether you have the stories in mind in total before you start writing, or do you take breaks between the stories?
Yes. Do I take, how does a story get written? Do I take breaks? All writers take breaks. That's where we shine. In between the stories, yeah. Yes. Well, I'm a dad now, and I didn't notice. I get so much more done now that I'm a dad. What I've lost is about 5 to 7 hours of ennui time. Like, I used to, like, lay on my fainting couch and look out the window and think. Now I just have to crack my knuckles and pay for preschool, you know. It's really, people are like, you're going to write less with a kid? A lot of Brooklyn writers are like, you're going to write less with a kid? I'm like, and I thought about it. I was like, I am. And I was like, they all have trust funds. If you live from it, you write faster with a kid. Anyway, but no, how does story take form? Yeah, for me, there's different parts of process throughout. So I'm a compulsive redrafter. My first story, The 27th Man, when I talk about what we talk about, when I talk about getting to that story and using my sister, most writers write really close personally and then move further as their reach moves further as they write, and I kind of working in the opposite direction. I was in a room much like this a bunch of years ago, and I called myself shy, and someone screamed out and got a big laugh like, you're not shy. And I was like, I'm private. It's a separate thing. But so that first story, you know, it's about these writers, the Night of the Murdered Poets, in 1952, all my stories are cheery. In 1952, Stalin killed these poets. these Jewish writers and some a group of people, but he had them murdered all on the same day, and I was obsessed, you know, with them being erased and their story and them being forgotten. I didn't want them to be forgotten, all these notions, but really it was my story. I was dreaming of being a writer. I didn't think anyone would ever read a word of it, that I'd ever sit in a room like this ever, and I just wanted to know, because I was going to write every day no matter what. And I was like, if I write every day till I die and no one reads it, do I die as a writer? So I wrote this story about a young writer who gets put in a cell with his legends unpublished by accident, a clerical error, and that's it. So the point is, I wanted to crack that story and crack the code of story and figure it out. I literally have probably as tall as me, which is not that tall, an inch taller than Napoleon, but I probably honestly have 5-6 feet of drafts. Like, I drafted and for years, I will draft and redraft compulsively. So I want to say, you write it till you get it right and do it again and again and again till you better not open your book and read it and want to change a comma. Like, it better be done when it goes in the world. You can't control how a world receives a book, but you can control that nobody sees it till you're done. But I want to tell you, over time I've learned, I can't tell you how much I believe in the subconscious. I'm so not touchy-feely, it's bizarre. It sounds bizarre, but we're talking about writing, which is dissociative states. Like when you, I did an event many years ago with the Rubin Museum in New York have these wonderful pairings. It'd be like a psychiatrist paired with Jacques Torres, like the chocolatier on pleasure centers. But bless you, but they paired me with this psychiatrist who's in charge of sleep to talk about dreams. But I learned from my friend Melissa, since we're very little, I don't want to hear your dream, she says. It's a dream, don't tell me. Anyway, so I said, what about the waking dream? What happens when we write? Because I noticed that I'll be typing, I'll see it every rare time. It was finishing the story Sister Hills in this book. I was working 12 hours a day on this story. Like, not a joke. The book was due. So let's say this book has 9 stories in it. You write 8 in privacy, and then you hand it in, and someone says, they're great. Now we need another great story. Writing a story that's supposed to be good to finish out is different than just doing your work. You know, it was so hard to write a story with the expectation, like, give us a good, you know, give me a killer, you know? And I was and I just thought about it, 12 hours a day, I'm not finding my way through, it's unfindable. I can't find the end of the story, I can't find the break. And then I said, wait a second, unless you're a plagiarist, how can you ever, I built the world, I make up every character, I know every fact, there is no one who could, there's nothing to be known about a story beyond what I know, because I know everything, I made it all up. So how could I know something on a Monday that I don't know on a Friday? It's impossible. It's just over. You can't ever know anything new, I know it all, I made it up. And I was sitting there and having one of those horrible days and called my friends. And then like 9 p.m. that at night, I'm typing as fast as I can. And I sort of like wake up mid-typing, you know, I'm like, I think this is it. I'm like, I can't even, you know, put the caps lock is on and I'm getting fragments of I'm mapping out the rest of my story and I'm thinking like, just stay in it for a second more. You'll get the map. And it reminded me of the ultimate betrayal, which is, you know, when you're learning to ride your bike and you're going down the street and your dad's supposed to be holding it. And then they're like, look, you're riding. And then you crash. And I'm always like, you learn to ride the bike. You also learn never to trust anyone ever again. I would think it'd be better if our kids didn't know how to ride bikes, but said, I trust my dad. He would never. I like went right up a telephone pole. Anyway, but the point is, that's literally what it felt like. And I thought, wait a second, I can't even walk and talk. Like, how could, if my finger, who, if me, Nathan, that's talking to you, is thinking, stay calm, Nathan, because you're getting the story, who's typing? You know what I'm saying? Like, I can't even explain the thought. And I talked to the psychiatrist about it, and he was so calm, he changed my life. Talking to another writer is like talking like to, you know, unrepentant alcoholics. Well, like, I drink a case of beer a day, and my friend's like, that doesn't sound like much, because he drinks 2, you know, like. But this is a man of science and a doctor, and he said to me, that's a classic disassociative state. He's like, it's what sports people do, and the religious, and yogis, and I got it, having been a religious person. In synagogue, it's makom kavua, your set place. My father had his place in the synagogue, I thought, because he was like a founding family, and therefore that's why you have your name on your seat, that's why it's your seat. And then I understood it's not. It's to come to the same place, to the same spot, to say the same prayer in the same way, day after day, year after year, and then you more quickly get to the transcendent place. So what I'm telling you is I have muscled like a bulldog through so many stories for so long, and then I learned, if anyone writes in here, to just like start them, I start a file, I have a million files, and then I wait and I do other work, and then one day they're just cooked, like a Hot Pocket. Yeah, so it's really changed my process. So anyone who's writing, I just saying, I teach so many, I know there's writers in here, they're like, I'm stuck, it's broken, you know, and I'm like, no, quit 15 stories, and then when you quit story 15, story one will be, you'll have a collection in no time, but you're not failing, you're like failing upward, you know, in a Beckettian manner. Yes.
I was so touched by your story, The Reader. Did you talk about that?
Oh, thank you. So there's a story, The Reader, which is about a writer who comes out of hiding, goes on tour, and he only ever has one reader following him around, and it becomes a sort of torturous thing. But bless you, you start to see back to themes that upset, like, what is it to be a writer? Shouldn't one be thankful? I'm so spoiled and I'm so thankful. But if one finds one true reader in life and communicates with one person in the world, isn't that the whole dream? It's almost, by the way, I recognize that. The 27th man, if I write and no one reads me, am I a writer? That's the pre-career. Like, this was after that first book, you know, thinking, after two books, thinking, you know, you can get so skewed in life. You know, my wife works in refugee education, stuff like that. So it's a big thing in, you know, where I live in my neighborhood. People be like, I'm poor. You know, I don't have a double wide brown. So, you know, like this notion of what your expectation is to be happy or to be rich or to be thankful. You know, so Western ideas of rich are very delicate in my house. Like, do you have food? You know, that's a pretty good starting spot. Anyway, but you know, on that writing front, you could really get skewed, and you just have to be, I'm so thankful, and I wanted to explore that notion of thankfulness, and I don't know if you should all read him, but this wonderful Israeli writer, Edgar Keret, but he's a good friend, and I was just in Rome this week, but this was another time we were in Rome together, and you just never, I can't tell you every night, I don't care if I know it's a community read, and I'm in great hands, and all that stuff, I don't know till I turn the corner if there's gonna be crickets. You know, I'm so thankful to Reshap, and we were just about to go on. We were like cackling like wild men. Like we were so, you know, in this big hall in Rome, and we're like, you know, could just be some Italian cousin of Edgar's. Like you just don't know, you know, till those doors open, if there'll be TV count, you just don't know. And I really wanted to explore that notion of the relationship between writer and reader. And again, to get back to that, it's sort of, you know, it's explored in a bunch of ways and it's kind of dark with this guy's obsessed with him. But I really do think that it is, if you're trying to make stuff in the world, if you find one person who connects with your work, like just a stranger who reads what you wrote and feels changed by it, that's, I don't think you should want, you know, for more, you can want for more than that, but I think you should be really thankful if you've connected with a stranger in this world. Yes.
I'm in two book clubs, and both of them like Camp Sundown the best.
Right.
And so did I. And because it was funny and also tragic. But I guess my question, which may seem trivial, is did you leave the ending open-ended on purpose? Of course you did. but we discussed in both clubs, you know, was the guy a nut? Was he a guard at their camp? And
yeah.
And they had different answers, and I just wanted you to touch on that.
Oh, I really haven't talked about these in years. It's so nice to be revisiting this book with you all. But yes, Camp Sundown, another cheery story. But yes, but these elder hostel campers, they decide one of the other campers is hiding out as an old Jewish elder hostel camper, but is really a Nazi in disguise, and they take vengeance upon him. But yes, back to not tying up the endings.
You know, like, is he a Nazi guard? That's what I really want to know.
So I guess I'm really interested. I really believe when you build a fictional reality, it should match a reality. Like, I spent almost a decade writing a book about Buenos Aires in 1976. I was six. I'm not from Buenos Aires. For me to build that world, I had to learn everything, their music and their foods and what the cool, you know, you listen to Fito Páez if you're into pop, but if you're naughty, you listen to Sumo. I learned the rock, the alternative rock, what the graffiti looks like, this idea to build realities. I can recognize that there's Buenos Aires that, you know, over there, and there's the Buenos Aires in my book. They both better be equally real. You know, you better pull that off. So I often think about what makes story real, and what makes story real is not having all the facts. You know what I'm saying? Like right now our country's in, I was just like glued to CNN to be like, you know, was there collusion or not? Was it like, that's the point of reality, which is this room would split up, I don't know the numbers in this town or how this specific room would break down, but like we all have versions of a story. You know, this country's like, And to me, the neatness of it, you know what I'm saying, right now, like, even if you, even in coupledom or your families, right, some friends of yours, like, you know, pick the cheater, I don't know, the, you know, the wife's cheating on the husband, you know, and their marriage is falling apart because she's been found, like, I just watched Friends split on that, where he's like, you know, Friend's like, oh, well, how could she do that? And the other one's like, how could she have waited so long? You know what I'm saying? Like, there's versions of things. And I think stories don't tie up neatly. Like, I feel like I failed you if, you know, if we're writing the story that said, again, the reader is always right. I really believe that. I will not argue with a reader. Like, it doesn't matter. If it says South Florida 15 times in this story that I read from, if you say that story's of yours with the Hasidim in, you know, in Vancouver, like, I guess I should have said South Florida a 15th time. But I'm saying, if you're lost or confused or, you know, that is my failure. You know, that has to be under control. But the idea of, I think of it like haiku, you know, like classic, you know, haiku poetry, there'd be like a butterfly and a bell, and you can feel the bell's gonna ring, you know, but it ends before that ringing. Like, I just think a story should move on, like life. There should be negative spaces. It should move on into the future. So if we don't know whether they took revenge or not, that story doesn't have an ending on it. But that notion that we have to wrestle with the unknowing, that's what I love as a reader. I studied with Frank Conroy, who was so wonderful. And such. I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop, and Marilyn Robinson and Frank Conroy and Tom, you know, Jim McPherson and Tom, wonderful people who changed my life, you know. But Frank, it was such a, he was so almost like a drill sergeant of writing, you know. He'd be like, if I can break you and you don't write, you don't have it in you. Or I'm like, well, I'm delicate and now I'm not writing. But anyway, but he was a genius and so loving. He really broke distance when I became a writer. It was fascinating. But he used to talk about a story having to function like a hallway. You know what I'm saying? If we walk down this hallway, you need the freedom to move side to side. Like, but, you know, that's how the hallway, it would be suffocating. Like, you have to be able to move and make choices, but you need to hit a wall on both sides, and there needs to be the direction. So to me, to over those bows, you know, like, sometimes, you know, from my very first book, For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, which is a story about a couple and a rabbi, you know, a guy's unhappy in his marriage, and the rabbi sends him to a prostitute. Long story. Anyway, but in the end of that story, people say, did the marriage stay together? And I was like, that's, I want the part in fiction. What I love is the argument, the why we have the book group. You know what I'm saying? That's, the to me, what the story's about is talking about those spaces, you know, and not being like, I couldn't tell if that guy was a guy or was that, you know, a rhesus monkey. Like, that's the failure, you know.
Okay, sorry. Oh, actually, I was going to ask basically the same question, but with the slight caveat of, do you, in your mind, I get the ambiguity as
yes.
a huge part of
yes.
the story, and actually he's sort of a minor part in
yeah.
it, but since you said you know everything about
yeah.
them, everything, do you have in your mind, not to share with us, do you have?
Oh.
I've opened a can of
worms. Oh, So it's turned into it's become part of my memory. So he's in this space, but no, when I'm right, sometimes I'm leading away, but again, I believe if that space is in there, it's like I consider my opinion, you know, less
yeah,
valid, but as...
I was gonna say, I can argue it either way, I just, God, I hate not knowing.
Yeah, I
can, but you're okay leading
yeah,
I
can't remember the construction of it in that way, but probably... I needed that space for him to have that space. I probably knew different things at different times.
That's where the reader gets to make it up.
Yes.
So there was somebody in the back.
Was, yes.
In the Anne Frank story, you write about the terrible, heavy...
Oh, that's, yes. How does comic and tragic work? So, and now we get to culture things, because I also think about what's New York and what's Jewish. Sometimes we're like, oh, that's so Jewish. I'm like, that may be New York, you know, those things. And then there's a specific thing with one of my best, you know, I always say, by the way, back to the stuff, and then I always have to, like, back to my fainting couch, I'm always, like, then having somebody just, I was with a writer, just called it a vent hangover. It's very overwhelming after, it's a very vulnerable thing to do, but don't come out, you came out of your house, I came out of my house, so if I'm not going to be myself up here, it's not worth coming. But my best, like, really, my old college buddy just called me. His father was a Holocaust, not in the camps, but, you know, in Hungary with the Nazis. You know, his father was, you know, very young and survived and got to the States. And, you know, yeah, he just called me to say, my son, like, really moved. He's like, he just told his first Holocaust joke. We had this really thing. He's like, if I want to pass on any Jewish tradition, it's the shocking Holocaust joke. So, And that really is a thing. You know, I'm 15, but my brother-in-law, like his father was, you know, his parents were survivors, you know, his father from Auschwitz, his mother from the woods. And, you know, like that idea, like the darkness, the humor, it just, so that specifically the Holocaust joke is the thing, you know, what that represents, what that does, how we process. But it just sticks with building realities, and that's it. Maybe it's more Jewish, maybe it's New York, maybe it is cultural, and some cultures are different that way. But I don't know. Back to building reality. If you just have Kissy, 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 you have a romance novel. If you just have, is he a Nazi or not, and are we going to catch him, then you have a mystery. Like, what is literature? To me, it just means, like, stories that are, whether they're magic realist or, you know, on the moon or whatever, that are giving a full reality. And to me, no emotion is full unless it contains a second emotion. That's just not, like, if somebody, God forbid, you shouldn't know from, and if someone calls you with bad news, there's always a joke if there's real intimacy with that horrible news. And when somebody calls, you know, with great news, if they're, like, not a, now we all, everyone think of their closest narcissist. It's like you're 15. But I'm saying, unless there's some horrible narcissist, they call with good news, they also take themselves down a peg because it's not so nice to brag. You know what I'm saying? Like, so I'm just saying, to me, those things go together. So if you're dealing with the Holocaust, comes the Holocaust joke. Because it's not, because actually, it's not a disrespect. It's, the way I see it, it's actually a respect, because the thing is so horrible that if we entertain it for a second, it's beyond soul-crushing what we do to each other in this world, you know what I'm saying? Or what's going on in the world. Like, how do we function? Where does the distance from you in tragedy end? You know, as I sit here and, you know, and the world is, you know, whatever, what, you know, Syria is happening as we do this. You know, like that idea, where is the world end? Where are our responsibilities end? That's a whole separate set of questions. But yes, to me, to recognize the darkness of that thing, it demands, to stay with it for a second demands a joke, because the horror is just beyond, you know, processing. Yes, sir.
You had two stories of Sister Hills and Three People Who Are Widows, where you have characters that have horrible things happen to
Yeah, but yeah, it's asking about Sister Hills and Free Fruit for Young Widows, and what, when people do horrible things in story after horrible things are done to them. This gets back to our first question, you know, which is, I grew up religious, and the right and wrong of it, it was wonderful, like a defined world. I'm trained. It's not a choice, like, oh, should I sleep on my side or on my back? It's very clear. You're not allowed to sleep on your back. It's naughty. You know what I'm saying? Like, we had rules for everything. When you eat, you know, just everything was defined, and everything was look upable. And when you, you know, reject that, as I did, that world, everything was this gray space, and I'm just obsessed with justice and injustice and what's right and wrong. And that's why I'm not a scientist, and not another, you know, many other reasons. But I'm just saying, I like to explore the formula without, you know, X plus Y over Z, like, but I just want to explore the question. I want to ask the questions. Fiction, this is from John Gardner, is a place to test values, as a place to reflect. That's what anyone who stands up here, and you're all book people if you're here, like, books saved my life. I think they'll cure cancer and grow hair. And the books that saved me that I love were the books that ask questions. So I ask questions in my stories and don't often leave those questions there. So, but on the Free Fruit for Young Widows story, I'll do two quick ones. That one, we'll make it Edgar Carrot night. On that same trip to Rome, two stories from this book from the same night in Rome, we went up to the roof, it was actually Calvino's old house, for the readers, where Calvino, his wife, widow's house, anyway, but we were there talking late into the night with other friends, and Edgar told this story, and he writes magic realist insane stories about, like, a, you know, an angel with no wing. I mean, they're brilliant and bizarre, but he told the story of his father's, a story of his father's about this guy and the war and, you know, the Suez Crisis. And I asked in Hebrew very politely, by the way, because it's a writer's thing, if you say, like, you know, I'm so sorry I'm late, my house just burned down, I'm like, what'd the dog do? Did you cry? You know what I'm saying? We're always hungry for details. We're supposed to first say, is everyone okay? You know, so he tells this personal story, and in Hebrew I said, like, may I interact with this as story, meaning can I ask you a question about the story part of the story? And he said, you know, but it's vague in Hebrew, it could be both, and he said, just take it, it's yours, I don't write that kind of story. So he gifted me his father's story, and so I wrote my version of it, which his father got to read before he passed away, which meant a lot to me, but it was just a wonderful writerly thing. But Sister Hills, I do want to talk about, because this is a story about contracts. You know what I'm saying? Which gets back to, I tried to answer it honestly and gingerly and welcomingly, but this gentleman's question about guns, like how we use the Constitution, it's how we use the Bible. I've studied the Bible, so you can be homophobic, but you can't be homophobic and anti-immigrant. Because the same page that says that's not okay also says not just you have to not kill immigrants or you can't close the door, it says, you know, I was a stranger in a strange land. If an immigrant, if somebody gets to where you are and asks you for something, you have to give them the keys to your Lexus. So I'm saying either it's a contract, you can be a homophobe, but only if your house is filled with illegal immigrants. Only. You know what I'm saying? Like if you're that close to the, but you can't say this is how I feel because the Bible says this, and then, but I'm also, it, so I'm obsessed with how the Bible gets used, the Constitution as a bludgeon where people have their own reading of malleable things and use them as a bludgeon. So yes, we can have guns in this country, not if our children are dying every day, basically, in school. Not acceptable. We must protect the children above all. Rule, fact, drowns everything. So Sister Hills, I want to study Greater Israel and biblical concepts, and I really wanted, as I said all night here, for people to be able to reflect on that story, and something accidental happened that I didn't intend, back to stories being out of my control, which is, it functioned like a Rorschach test. People read that story, and right-wing people said, see, this is why we need Greater Israel, because of this story, and then left-wing people would say, this is why the occupation is a sin, and Israel needs two states from this story, and because I have a lot of Jewish readers, they'd say, I'm right-wing, why'd you write this left-wing story? I'm left-wing, why'd you write that? And I'd never written anything that so was a template for people to bring themselves to in such a specific, malleable manner, and it literally ended up being what sparked, not writing the story, I'm back to getting to interact with readers. It wasn't writing the story, it was traveling the story and talking to my readers. Like that was, I learned so much that it became why I built this novel, Dinner at the Center of the Earth, literally, because I said I want to build an Israel-Palestine story that takes no sides, that swings back and forth so we can just see why we feel what we feel. So yes, both those stories explore extremely harsh things and ideas of vengeance and law because I'm obsessed with, you know, the gray space. You pulling the plug?
So I think we can have one more very short question, and I think your hand has been up.
Okay, thank you. Like, who do you envision as your reader? That's part of the question, because you do not paint Jews as, you know, the chosen people, as flawless people. You paint us as conflicted people, sometimes good, sometimes not so good, and usually all in between.
That's very easy for me. I think writers should never, I feel like I would do a collected, I would love to do a long article that's just people's answer to like who they're writing for, because I feel like it's writers, I see people answering it and doing their best to answer it and then saying things that I don't think is really what they think and trying to put it into words, because it's so amorphous. It's a universal, it's the one, it's the everyone, it better be universal. I can tell you what's moving to me, back to that, whereas like, with, you know, I'm so thankful for my support from the Jewish community and stuff like that. I love when I'm in a place like when I'm reading in Bergen, Norway, and I'm like, there are no, or the Jew of Bergen will come out for me, you know what I'm saying? But it's so beautiful to me what story does, like that someone takes every word I've written, I think of that concept, replaces it with a different word in a different language, takes its around the world from where I, like, I've written it. You know, like, back to that idea of, like, someone, you know, saying to me, like, in, you know, when I was in Lagos, Nigeria, but this kid saying to me, like, I got your book on the bridge, like, back to physical copy time. Like, how did that book get around the world tonight? Like, this notion. So, the universal, so it's forever, yes, there is the reader and the concept of the reader, but it's a universal thing. But back to your question, which you're asking very nicely, which is maybe it's upsetting to you certain representations of Jews, or the concept, is it disrespectful? I don't know, but I'm not putting...
Well, it's a, I find it really refreshing and freeing and sort of like it's good for, it's good for people to understand that. You know.
So this is the point, and I have the wonderful thing back to a writer's life, like I have a nice friendship with Philip Roth, who was not a person to me, like he's, you know, he was this religious kid and found Portnoy's Complaint. My mom had a row of books in those old Chesterfields with the metal grids, and I was bored with the front row of books, and behind it was bored, and I was complaining. Anyway, that was really helpful for me. But I'm saying, like, I remember the first time I got attacked by, like, someone for being, you know, some very conservative Jewish person, and a friend called Philip, right before I met him, he said, that's the first word I ever got from Philip was, he'll get over it. You know, like, but this notion, which is when people try and not be human, that's when they get dehumanized. When you make genocide, we can go to Rwanda, the first thing you hear on the radio, those things are, they're roaches. You know, when you hear people being compared to animals and things like that, that's the first part of dehumanization. And I think sometimes people do the reverse, which is they think other people, if they don't put on this perfect face, that is not a human face. You know, even in that question, you're saying in your books there's happy Jews and sad Jews and honest Jews. I'm not putting words in yours, but I'm saying that notion, to me, that gets back to how we started this, which is, I'm just talking about people, and there's every range of people, and to me, it's what people bring to it in their own sensitivities if they think it's transgressive or painting Jews in a bad light or painting them in a good light. Like, that's what everyone brings to it. And I recognize, back to how we started this with the Charlottesville question, is how fortunate I am. Like, literally, you know, I was thinking about it. You know, I just was living in Malawi for a year. Whenever this other couple left, I would send an email out, you know, or a text thing to the group. I was like, the Jewish population has decreased by 50%. We were the four Jews of Zomba, Malawi. But I'm saying, like, between me and my bagel store, I walk by probably 50,000 Jews before I get to the, like, my universe. Like, Jews are not threatened. They're not, you know what I'm saying? We are. It's
with
such
Israel, like, with, you know, like,
yeah, I live in Israel and I live in New York, like, it doesn't, you know, because I sometimes, the further I go afield in certain places, people think, like, how can you be representing people simply as people, you know? And to me, I think it's act like that notion where Philip Roth, you know, his dirty books were going to embarrass, probably more people know about Jews around the world, you know, before this new generation came up, from Philip Roth's and Saul, you know, Flawed Jews, and Saul Bellow's Flawed Jews, and Grace Paley's Awesome Flawed Jews, you know what I'm saying? Like, so I think in a sense, people can feel, I love the defensiveness, because I know where it comes from when people are defensive, but I think it's the exact opposite. Showing anyone as human in any community is what makes them, you know, it's a protection. Anyway.
I'm sorry, that's all the time we have.
We're so lucky we got to have Nathan Englander come here.
Yeah, and we're really looking forward to whatever next year's Same Page brings.
Yes. And that is all funded by the wonderful friends of the library who also fund this podcast. So a big thank you to them again as well.
Yes. If you would like to become a friend or learn more, go to jmrlfriends.org. And a little bit of reminder that even though the Gordon Avenue Library is closed this month for renovations, the Friends of the Library will be open accepting books.
From 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. each day, including Saturday. So it's Monday through Saturday. So once again, thank you for tuning in. Be sure to hit subscribe wherever it is that you listen to this podcast.
And leave reviews if you feel so inclined.
Yes.
We appreciate all of the positive feedback.
Yes. And take suggestions into account.
Yeah. And if you have an idea for someone we should talk to on the podcast, we're happy to hear it. You can email us at podcast@jmrl.org.
That's all for us today. Thanks for tuning in.
And as always, we are glad to be on the same page.
That's weird.
I mean, I think it's weird.